and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. To reach its decarbonisation goals, the maritime industry needs radical ideas. Those are the words of Mathieu de Thugny, Executive Vice President, Marine and Offshore at Bureau Veritas. In his second book, he invites the shipping industry to think big and calls for a revolution in how the global fleet is financed, fueled, and operated. He joins us now to explore what this means in practice and how he sees the energy transition unfolding for the maritime sector. Welcome to the podcast, Mathieu.
Thank you, Ariane. My pleasure being here.
Well, pleasure to have you. I guess, first of all, you write in your book that for the past two decades, the decarbonisation debate has been largely centred on finding the perfect solution. So one fuel or technology that would be cheap, easy, and adopted by everyone. But you also write that this is a chimera. So do you believe that the shipping industry is now starting to accept that the transition is going to be expensive and complicated?
Yeah, right. I think the shipping industry is getting more and more aware, you know, of the needed investments to meet the decarbonization. And in that respect, we start thinking that, yes, there would be a cost, you know, behind that, a cost, you know, to address the new fuels on one side, but as well to address the new technologies, you know, to be fitted on board, you know, to meet the new regulations. So it's a cost. And we know that overall, the energy, you know, will be growing more and more in terms of demand, you know, in the future, whatever in the industry is. And in that respect, the cost, you know, will be higher and higher. All the more that you're going to have a certain competition between the different industries, you know, to reach out the best fuel.
And are we any closer to agreeing on who has to pay for that extra cost in the shipping industry?
That's, you know, what we call more or less a chicken and eggs scenario here. But there is a certain consensus that at the end of the day, you know, the end user, you know, will pay more than before. But again, this is for the benefits of the planet. So I think there will be an accepted effort in that respect. And we start seeing that if, of course, the solution, you know, looks a bit complicated as we speak today, there will be a scalable effect in the future, making that once the supply chain is ready, the cost will be lower than we do expect today.
At the same time, you write in your book that, and I quote here, for the majority of vessels, the current economics reward those who wait. So what are the practical actions that need to happen to change this? And who has the power to do so on such a scale?
I think it's a good question, because in a certain world of uncertainties, you know, as we are living through today, the wait and see approach is probably, you know, the best way, you know, in terms of paying off. We know it's not sustainable. You know, it's not sustainable in the sense that if we don't do anything, you know, we won't decrease the level of, you know, greenhouse gas emission in the world. So maybe two main actions here, which are very relevant. The first one is probably to bring some consistency in the policy and the regulations. And we know there are a few actions in that respect today to, let me say, bringing some competitive advantage for the doers, but as well bringing some, financial assistance, you know, to the conservative, players here. So it should be a win-win for in that respect. And on the other one, I think it's important to bring a more assurance and certainty to the infrastructure investment, because it's not only about the ship, but all the supply chain here. So we need to ensure that the shoreside providers, you know, have the visibility and the certainty to justify their business case and their investments, which are absolutely a must, you know, for this decarbonization.
You said just now that the end user is going to have to pay more. You also mentioned that there's going to need to have some incentives for first movers, so some financial support also for ship owners to be able to do that transition. I just wondered, what are your views on how doable it is politically in the context that we know of increased cost of living and inflation and so on?
I think it's important to bring some clarity, you know, to the investment and the lending decisions here. Financing is certainly structural enabler, you know, of decarbonization here. We've seen several initiatives in that respect. We all have in mind, for instance, the Poseidon principle purposes. We have the Sea Cargo Charter, which brings more transparency between the different shipping stakeholders. We have as well the Ajax and, of course, the different class societies' ability to de-risk the solutions and bring the confidence, you know, in the different solutions. So all these different actions, I think, will bring assurance and confidence, you know, in the financing of this decarbonization. And this is important to remind that, because without bringing, you know, these different initiatives, there will be a lack of confidence. And when there's no confidence, there's no investment. So that's, I think, very important to stimulate that.
Which brings me to another point that you raised in your book about finance and insurance being geared towards proven technology, which often means conventional fossil fuels. Do these finance and insurance institutions now have a responsibility to take more risks so that those first movers that you're referring to can secure the finance and the insurance that they need? How can we and who can convince them to change their ways?
It's part of this global journey. And I think we start seeing a few initiatives that I just mentioned, you know, with the Poseidon principles, etc., etc., bringing the need, you know, to green financing, you know, these different investment that we have to, and probably to accelerate and stimulate these investments, we need as well some other, you know, additional measures. The first one is, for instance, the regulatory measures, where the IMO, you know, midterm measures, which bring some incentives, you know, to decarbonize, you know, in a faster way at the shipping industry. We have as well other initiatives, you know, bringing clarity from scale perspective, the green corridors, you know, bringing assurance, you know, in the supply chain components here. And probably what is still missing, and to further emphasize, this is the relation, you know, between IMO, for instance, the shipping regulatory body, and the financial regulators, which need to discuss further, you know, between each other, and bringing more, you know, concrete actions, you know, to finance, you know, the decarbonization. That's the main enablers I have in mind here.
And in terms of that closer relationship between the IMO and financial regulators, for example, what could that look like in practice?
I think this is certainly initiatives to finance further, incentivize further the green investments in the shipping industry. You know, how to bring incentives to the doers. It's a heavy cost, you know, when you decarbonize, you know, your fleet, for instance, either using new fuels or bringing some energy efficiency on board the vessels. So to do that, you need green financing and making sure that the capital risk, which is very often raised, you know, by the banks, you know, will be more considered by those people. And here, some closer relationships, you know, between the financial regulators and the people who are regulating the shipping industry, the IMO, you know, we'll find out some concrete measures here.
And you've mentioned the Poseidon principles just now. What is your assessment of how successful that initiative has been so far? And is that the way to go to expand that idea of green financing?
I think that has been a great, you know, first initiative here. And I think it's pretty successful in the sense that you have more and more members, you know, within the Poseidon Principle Associations. So that's the first step, but we need more steps, of course. And if you just look at, you know, what IMO, you know, has decided or proposed, you know, in the recent measures, I think this is the first time, you know, in the industry as a whole, not only in the shipping industry, that we can see so highly advanced, you know, decarbonization measures supporting by specific financing, funding, if I should say. And, you know, when you look at the IMO Association today, so they're proposing unprecedented, you know, measures of mandating the reduction of greenhouse gas. It's getting more and more, you know, an increased administrative role with the GFI registry. And at the top of that, we have this financial role, which is certainly a new measure we have never seen before, to reward, you know, the most efficient owners and to be, more proactive regarding your transition with the others. So that's, I think, very unique, you know, in terms of new measures, initiatives. But of course, there are still a lot of, things to do in the meantime until, you know, those measures are concretely, implemented.
Speaking of the IMO net zero framework, obviously that was approved by NEPC 83 in April. We still have to see the formal adoption, which is scheduled for October. Is it fit for purpose? Is it going to help in solving that cost side of the equation? I mean, here, the price gap between conventional and green fuels. And yeah, is it likely to work, in your opinion?
I think the concept, because we need to talk about concept, because it's not yet, you know, implemented and fully approved, is right. But there are many pending items, you know, to be solved here to make it fully appropriate. It's a long run in that respect. And we need to make sure that all the measures which will be part of it will be fair and will be helpful, you know, for the different solutions, including for the transition. Because we are all hopeful, you know, for ultimate fuels in the future, you know, free of carbon. But it can't be right away. And we need to accept, you know, and develop some transition measures. All the more, you know, we talk about the whale-to-wake approach. It's not an easy matter. So we need to assess all of that and, again, make sure that we're going to have a transition to the ultimate goal, you know, 2050 net zero emission. So that's, I think, feasible, again, if we comply with these different steps.
And you talked about putting in place those intermediate steps. What does that look like in your view? What does that look like in practice?
Well, I think there are, for instance, the different fuels we can use as part of this transition. There has been a lot of discussions with the LNG, for instance, you know, as a transition fuel. Good to remind that it was the first fuel that was used, you know, on large size container ships, for instance, with pretty effective results, you know, almost 20% of greenhouse gas emission reduction. Then the next step, you know, on the basis of that fuel, you know, could be the biofuel with a certain blending and ultimately, you know, the ELNG. So I think it's important to respect, again, these different steps because it cannot be, you know, right away from 100% to zero. It would be a wrong mistake and I think a heavy investment, if any. So different steps, and of course, all the operational measures, you know, that you can have on board, you know, to reduce the emission as well, which would be very important.
One thing you note in your book is that progress on decarbonization so far has been quite mixed because technology is progressing. However, 90% of the global fleet still runs on fuel oil. Are you optimistic that the pace of the energy transition will accelerate and that this will be enough to reach net zero by 2050? Or are you in the other camp that says that these objectives should be reassessed and we need a more pragmatic view?
That's not an easy question here because, you know, if we have in mind the Paris Agreement and the 1.5 degree, you know, of increase by 2050, we know that it won't be reachable realistically, you know. So we are in an emergency situation where you have to act all the more, you know, to reduce this temperature raise. But let's be optimistic. And let's try to have all the measures and possible actions, you know, to be accelerated. We need to accelerate the process for sure. There are different actions in behind. Of course, we have the IMO measures. We have sometimes regional measures with European measures. We had a few investments ongoing for the supply chain. I think that will be critical. The shipping industry, in other respect, is innovating a lot I think this is something we should not forget, and we have not been static over the past years. Shipping has been not only reactive, in a reactive mode, but I think in a very proactive mode. So from that perspective, I'm optimistic, but a lot to do, a lot to do.
And now, if we look at the challenge from the perspective of an individual ship owner, and particularly owners of smaller fleets or ships that are operated on tramp markets, the reality is that often they don't have the same resources or the same ability to take risk on new fuels or technologies as larger companies, perhaps. So aside from energy efficiency improvements, which we've talked a lot about, what can they and what should they realistically do in the short term without putting their businesses in jeopardy? Or are these owners of smaller fleets kind of condemned to just sit back and wait?
That's a very sensitive point, absolutely. We have a large part of the worldwide fleet, for instance, you know, tramping, you know, and not necessarily, you know, on a liner's, you know, route. So my recommended approach here would be first to develop a strategy per company and maybe per ship, because you may have so many different type of ships we know within the same company, and assess probably, you know, the vessel capability and see how to prioritize, you know, the cost-effective solutions with respect to the decarbonization. And to do that, there are several possible options related to the efficiency of the vessel from a technical perspective or an operational perspective, using a transition fuel, which could be biofuels. And I'm not talking about the other fuels, especially for the small companies at this stage. We have as well the options of pooling, you know, some ships and share, you know, some common practice. So I think that there are, again, different options, but good to have some incremental, you know, improvements first as part of this strategy, with considerations ultimately for new fuels. And in the meantime, you know, having some potential support mechanisms with, you know, industry guidance, government incentives, or sharing some knowledge platform, you know, etc., etc. So a few things where I would really invite, you know, any owners, or let's say, because we are talking about small companies, you know, to be more familiar with that.
But is it your view that owners of smaller fleets are not going to be early adopters of ammonia or methanol or other types of alternative fuels?
Exactly, because it doesn't sound realistic at all. And, you know, even talking about the new fuels, you know, ammonia and so on, we need first of all to prove, you know, all these new developments with pilot projects. Some of them, you know, are already on track now, but it will take some time. And because of the cost, because of the safety sensitiveness issues, it will take some time. That's why in the meantime, for the smaller owners, as you said, having a strategy, a customized strategy per vessel, per company, should be the first step for me.
What is the timeline in which you see these alternative fuels or new fuels becoming more mainstream and companies in the tramp trade or smaller companies being in a position to be able to turn to fuels that would be net zero?
I think when we look at the different projects worldwide and the maturity, you know, of these projects, it's difficult to consider some, let's say, a common practice by 2030. But between 2030 and 2035, the investments, you know, will be materialized, and we're going to see more and more, supply chains ready for a certain number of new fuels. And hopefully with owners, you know, using that fuels for the benefits of the planet.
You wrote in your book that classification societies themselves will need to evolve to support the energy transition. So what would the ideal class society look like in 2030, 2040? And what needs to change today to get there?
I think, you know, when we look at the history of the class societies over the past two centuries, you know, we started with safety first, safety at sea. Then we move on to the prevention from the pollution. And now the topic is more about the performance and the protection of the environment. So the rules, regulations, guidelines, you know, shall evolve, you know, in that respect. And class society have, of course, by definition, a critical role here. The second role, which probably is the most important one for me, is that when you look at the different stakeholders making all this shipping ecosystem, class societies, you know, are really at the cross, you know, of all these different parties to connect them and moderate, you know, all these ecosystems to find out the right solution. As a class society, we are working with the builders, the designers, the operators, the owners, the financial bodies, charterers, bringing some advice, etc., etc. So I think we have the great position, moderating, mitigating the risk, assessing as well the best solutions for the future. That should be at the core business of the class societies.
So do you see classification taking more of an advisory role, for example, going forward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as there's no conflict of interest with the pure class business, which is conformity assessment. But definitely, yes. You know, we have gained some experience over the past decades in the shipping industry. And with all of that, you know, I think we should feel more comfortable, you know, to bring some advice in that respect, you know, towards the best solutions.
Now, I want to talk to you about the role of artificial intelligence, because AI is making its entry in a number of sectors across the economy, across society, and shipping is no exception. So what tangible AI applications have the most potential for the maritime sector? And what is BV's plan to use AI capacity going forward?
Yeah, I think the AI has fantastic, you know, power for the future. I'm absolutely excited about that, because we're going to develop, I think, some efficiency enablers for the shipping industry as a whole, and of course for the class societies in that respect. AI, for me, will bring a lot of improvements in terms of data management and optimization in the operations of the fleet, you know. We start seeing a few initiatives, you know, developments with different shipping companies, and definitely we start seeing the benefits of that. If we, it could be about route optimization, for instance. It can be about improvement of the maintenance of the fleet, improvement of the operational aspects of the fleet. So a lot of options here, which will drastically, you know, improve the performance of the fleet. And as far as class societies are concerned, in BV, we started to develop a certain strategy, you know, with the AI, and we have a couple of use cases now. We are experimenting, you know, for different shipping with different shipping actors. One of them, for instance, this is how to detect the corrosion within the tanks of the vessels and assess, you know, the evolution of this corrosion, which has been identified. We developed some specific algorithm and, you know, initiated that what we call augmented surveyor, you know, principle, where at long term, you know, this augmented surveyor scheme, you know, will definitely help the surveyor to optimize the survey, making that survey safer as well from a quality and safety perspective, using drones, for instance, able to capture this corrosion and develop the corrosion recognition, as I just mentioned earlier. So that's one option. The other one, this is to consider, you know, the different class items to be surveyed on board a vessel, and moving to more predictive approach rather than a prescriptive approach as we used to do in the past. So data management will be definitely a strong enabler for the future.
There's a growing focus also on the challenge of training and upskilling literally tens of thousands of seafarers to make sure that they're equipped with the right knowledge to deal with new technologies and new fuels, some of which are very toxic or flammable, for example. Where should we even start, and what role can classification play there?
In this transformation, the upskilling of the crew is certainly a challenge for our industry. And on a similar note, you know, this is a challenge for the class societies because, you know, surveyors of the class societies are the assets of the company. So it's important to make sure that all our surveyors, you know, are trained, qualified, you know, towards all these new technologies or new fuels. And as you said, toxic, flammable. So you need to be fully aware, you know, of the different characteristics of all these fuels. So as we speak, you know, we are developing some new training modules to make sure that our staff will be very aware, familiar, you know, with these new components or new technologies, and able to de-risk, you know, what they're going to see on board for the clients, but as well to protect themselves on board the vessels. So yes, training is probably the main challenge of the shipping industry for the years to come.
And to finish, after 6 years at the head of BV Marine and Offshore, you're about to step into a new role as Executive Vice President for Industrials and Commodities. I wonder, what has been your biggest learning from your years dedicated to maritime?
You know, for me, it's been a very exciting adventure, you know, the shipping industry, which I like very much. But my two main key takeaways here is that the shipping industry first is critical, you know, to the planet. Just one number, you know, 90% of the goods, you know, are transported at sea. So I think this is a good evidence of that. So it's a critical component, you know, in our life. And the second important key takeaway for me, you know, the shipping industry has been moving for the past, two centuries, for instance, across different industrial evolutions or revolutions. And let's remind that shipping has been very innovative to face these different evolutions or revolutions. So innovation is not new. We talk a lot about innovation today. We will face it once again. No worries about that. So, very, very exciting industry for me.
So you're optimistic about what comes next?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mathieu.
My pleasure, Ariane.